Thank you for being in our assembly tonight to worship God. We talked about the good works that the Christian does in our lesson this morning. Tonight, let's talk a little bit about the motives for doing righteousness. Those motives are important. Jesus told us in Matthew 6, beginning in verse 1, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." In this passage, we're given another warning. We're given many warnings in the New Testament. They're all very important. This one is no less important. It has to do with practicing righteousness, which should be characteristic of the Christian. We're to be careful to be zealous, doing good deeds. We do righteous acts. Jesus said, be careful when you do that, because the reason that you do it is very important. We would expect that would be the case, since God can see the content of our heart and know what is in our heart when we do what we do in this life. It's very important with our relationship with God for our hearts to be right before Him. Sincere hearts, genuine, pure, doing things from the right motives. By the way, motive means something such as a need or desire that causes a person to act. Motive implies an emotion or desire operating on the will and causing it to act. This is from Webster's Dictionary. The International Reference Dictionary has this: the ultimate inner reason for performing a given act. I like that. It's concise and simple. The ultimate inner reason for performing an act. The inner reason that you have that promotes activity in your life. What's the reason you do a certain thing? For example, we may think about a person who obeys the gospel. We may ask the question, why? We may see someone obey the gospel. That's certainly a righteous and good thing, isn't it? There may be someone who obeys the gospel because they want to enjoy the forgiveness of sins that the Lord offers. They want to have a home with God in heaven after this life is over. Good motives, pure motives, motives that would be in accord with what Christ would recommend were He teaching among us today. On the other hand, there may be someone who obeys the gospel of Christ that does not do it for those reasons. Someone may feel pressured into doing it. Someone may do it to satisfy the yearning of one's parents or one's grandparents, one's family members. One may obey the gospel of Christ in order to be in better standing with his family, and do it with those type of motives, because if that person feels that it is expected of him by other people, that would be the wrong motive, wouldn't it? So if we think about a person obeying the gospel and why they do it, there's a need for forgiveness. There's the desire for heaven. That's harmonious with our definition. Motives can be good or they can be bad. We need to recognize that. We see that in the Bible. We just mentioned a situation where that would be true. If we do righteous acts because God wants us to do them and that's what motivates us to do them, that would be well and good. If we do righteous acts in order that men may look at us and consider us to be righteous, that would be an impure motive. One cannot discern the nature of the motive by observing the act only. We may see people do acts of righteousness. By our mere seeing them do something, we cannot tell what their motives are. We have no way of knowing what their motives are unless they tell us what their motives are and they're telling us the truth. The mere observance of an act brings forth no righteous and true conclusion in our hearts about why a person does a certain thing. So one cannot discern the nature of the motive by observing the act only. A person may give, and he may give cheerfully, and he may give with generosity in his heart because he loves God and he loves his brethren, and those would be pure and good motives. Others may give, as Jesus pointed out in Matthew chapter 6, to be seen of men, to be honored of men, to be recognized of men. A person may attend worship services in order to worship in spirit and in truth as the holy commandment of God recommends, as it commands, to worship in spirit and truth. And then another individual may attend the worship services for the purpose of finding something that is distasteful, so that that person in their own mind can feel somewhat justified in forsaking the Lord. Christ brings the motive test to bear upon three activities in Matthew chapter 6. We are probably somewhat familiar with this passage in Matthew 6, going all the way through verse 18. But three activities are mentioned there: the act of giving, the act of praying, and the act of fasting. So let's look at this section. Jesus begins that by saying, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them." That would be the motive. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father in heaven. And what Jesus indicates by that statement is, we do have a reward of our Father in heaven if we do this with a pure motive. He says, when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. You see, there's that motive. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. They shouldn't expect a reward from God with that kind of motive. They're receiving their reward when men honor them. He said, when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. It's important for us to think about our acts of good deeds, our acts that we do in righteousness toward God, and the reason that we do it. He says, when you pray, in verse 5, you're not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen of men. There's the motive. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret, what is done in secret will reward you. Looking at verse 16 of Matthew 6, whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face, as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. There's the motive. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. These instructions are not a command for us to go through life with the drive of making sure that no one ever sees us do anything that could be classified as a righteous or good deed. Is it? Is that the force of the command? Is it a warning against living as a disciple of Christ openly for people to be able to see what you do? That's not the full import of the warning, is it? We're not forbidden to do righteous acts before other people. As a matter of fact, Christianity is not to be concealed under a bushel. We're to be the light of the world. People are to see that light. Christianity is not concealed under a bushel. We don't hide our Christianity from other people. It is allowed to show it, and we must allow it to show itself and not hide it. It must radiate like a lamp on a stand in order that the world may be benefited. Here's what Jesus said about that. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your lights shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You know, a lot of times the only way that many people ever see anything about Jesus Christ is when they see something in our lives as His followers. It's sad to think, as many Bibles as there are published in this world today, and as many Bibles as we're pretty confident can be found in most every household in our country, it's sad to think about the fact that people very seldom open those Bibles and read them and study from them and look at them to see what God has told people The only way some people ever see Jesus Christ is by looking at what somebody else is and what somebody else does. Peter declared that a Christian woman may win her non-Christian husband to the Lord by her manner of life before him in 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 3. So Jesus is not saying, don't ever do anything when the possibility is open that somebody might see you doing it. That's not the point he's making at all. Exemplified Christianity is a very convincing argument. And that's what Peter instructs women with unbelieving husbands, to live in such a way to bring glory to Christ, and it will cause your husband to give thought to your lifestyle and the reason for it. No doubt, many persons would still be in their sins if it had not been for a Christian living the life in pursuit of Jesus Christ so that they could see it. Our motive must not be to be seen of men or to be honored of men. This is what is prohibited. It was not given to control our activities, but it was given instead to govern the reason for our activities, why we do what we do, our motives which produce our activities. The Lord condemns some ostentatious, showy type of giving and works that are performed in order to receive human praise and human acclaim. Jesus called people who did this in this very passage hypocrites. A hypocrite in the bad sense is an actor or a dissembler. A dissembler is one that hides under a false appearance to conceal facts, intentions, or feelings under some pretense or some disguise. One who is playing a part is a hypocrite. One who is putting on an act is a hypocrite. Jesus says they have their reward in full. They shouldn't expect anything from the Father. They were trying to acquire the reputation of being benevolent, righteous people so that men would recognize them as such and they would enjoy some measure of favor as a result of that recognition. They were seeking the praise of men. They would get their reward, but it wouldn't be coming from God. They will only get that which they were seeking, the honor and applause of men. In living for Christ, not only must we do the right thing, we must do the right thing from the proper motives. The Bible gives us several examples of wrong motives. Let's think about wrong motives just for a minute. In the Old Testament, in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 21, here is one. It is a passage that indicates to us King Saul's motive for having his daughter, giving permission of his daughter to marry David. And here's what Saul was thinking, we are told in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 21. I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. King Saul gave his daughter to Saul, to David, his daughter Michal, in marriage to David, but notice what his motives were. I want the Philistines to be able to beat him, to ultimately kill him, and I want her to be a trap, a snare, for him. What an impure motive for granting permission for a child to marry someone. That wouldn't be righteous at all, would it? Many parents have had selfish motives for encouraging their children to marry certain individuals. There are parents who encourage their children to marry certain ones so that it may improve their social standing. You've heard the expression probably, marry up, which means marry up the scale, whether it be a social standing scale or a prosperity scale. Many parents encourage their children to marry someone that has a great social standing, some social position, some political clout, some material wealth. Others have had selfish motives in trying to restrain their children from marriage We don't want you to get married. You do too much for us around the house here. Who would do all of these chores? We'd rather keep you at home. You see, those wouldn't be good motives for someone trying to establish a family of his own. So the motive thing can have a very personal application for us as well, particularly with regard to marriage. There's another passage in Matthew 2, verses 1 through 8. And you may recall, we mentioned this recently, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, the Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. They were looking to honor this newborn king, and they happened to go to Jerusalem and asked Herod where they might find the king. And this caused great trouble in the city of Jerusalem. And Herod secretly called the Magi, determined from them the exact time that the star appeared, and sent them to Bethlehem. And here's what he said: "Go and search carefully for the child, and when you have found him, report to me, so that I too may come and worship him." But the scriptures reveal to us that Herod had no intention of coming and worshiping the one that they recognized as the king. Herod was a hypocrite. He didn't want to give any worship to this child at all. What he really wanted to do is what he attempted to do by having all male children 2 years old and younger put to death. He shed innocent blood all over the countryside around Bethlehem. A horrific act for anyone to do. His motives were wrong, you see. The local gossiper may respond to your invitation to attend the worship services here in order to find out who goes here, in order to find out some information about someone who goes here. That wouldn't be a pure motive for someone responding to your invitation to come here and worship God and study the Bible, would it? Sometimes young people may attend assemblies in order to socialize strictly with boyfriends or girlfriends. That wouldn't be a strong motive, righteous motive, pure motive for someone coming here to worship God or study the Scriptures, would it? Especially if they come with little or no thought concerning the things of Jehovah. It's not to say we don't like to invite young people to come thinking they'll have all the wrong motives. That's not true. We're not judges of people's motives from that aspect. But it is important that when we assemble to worship God and invite others to do the same, that we have the right motive and they have the right motive too. There's another passage in John 6, verses 22 through 27. The crowds were listening to Jesus teach. The disciples had gone away in a boat. There were other small boats from Tiberias near the place where they ate the bread after the Lord had given thanks. When the crowd saw that Jesus was not there, his disciples were not there, they themselves got into small boats and came to Capernaum seeking Jesus. And when they found him on the other side of the sea, here's what they said to him: "Rabbi, when did you get here?" Jesus answered them and said, you know, he's not interested in them knowing his timetable for travel, but he is interested in something about them. And something prompted him to point to answer their question, not about his travel plans, but about the content of their heart. That was the most important thing. Notice in verse 26 of John 6 that Jesus answered them and said, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." You see, the Lord who sees the hearts of everyone points directly at their motives. My travel schedule is not important, but what is the content of your heart. Why are you here? And I'll tell you why you're here, because I see what is inside of you. It is because you ate of the loaves and were filled. In other words, they had a free meal ticket. And then Jesus said, "Do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you, for on him the Father God has set his seal." So their motive for following Christ was physical. It wasn't spiritual at all. Perhaps some today have had motives similar to this by finding where Christians meet for the purpose of asking them for money. Raymond Harville many years ago told me when he was preaching in Paragould, Arkansas, he said there was a couple that came by the church building where his study was located, and they were asking for money. And he was talking to them, and they told him that they left Chicago on the way to Virginia. And he said, well, why are you in Paragould, Arkansas? And they said, well, that's the shortest way. Now, you can take your map out and locate Chicago and anywhere in Virginia and draw a straight line to anywhere in Virginia, and Paragould, Arkansas is not on that line. Is Robert Turner wrote an article about a couple who came by asking for money, so he started asking them questions. Are you a member of the Church of Christ? Oh, yes, we are. Well, what's the preacher's name where you attend? I can't remember. Well, what about the elders? Do you have elders there? Oh, yes. Well, what are their names? You know, I forgot their names. Well, can you give me the name of the organist? No, I can't really remember that either. Now, there's just something fishy about that, isn't there? Motives, how important they are. In John 8, beginning in verse 3, the scribes and Pharisees brought a woman to Jesus. She was caught in adultery. And they advanced her into the presence of Jesus and said, Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now, the law of Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say? Now, what do you suspect their motive was for asking such a question as this? John tells us in verse 6, they were saying this, testing him so that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus saw through their motives, being able to see into the hearts of other people. Here's the question. Did they bring this woman to Jesus in order to help her? In order to encourage her not to do wrong? In order to give her an audience with the Lord whereby she may be forgiven and encouraged because she was speaking with the Son of God to forsake committing adultery? Was that the reason why they brought her? No. They wanted Jesus to give an answer to their question which would violate the law of Moses. To place this as an official charge against him and have him condemned by the Sanhedrin, thus destroying his influence with the people. Now, if the Lord had said, well, she's an adulteress, what we ought to do with her is what the law says do, take her out and stone her, then he would have been in violation of Roman law. People today have similar motives when they ask Christians what they believe on various subjects. You ever been talking to someone in the workplace? Someone at school, someone you're associated with, and they ask you a question that kind of seems off the wall a little bit. What do you think the mark of the beast is in the book of Revelation? Now, you know, the average person in our world today really shouldn't be concerned about what the number 666 mean in the book of Revelation and what the mark of the beast is. What they really need to be concerned about first is, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Because that's going to lead them to salvation. So we get all kinds of questions like this. And a lot of times people ask us questions in order to discredit us as a Christian who could help them learn the truth. And if you don't give them the answer that they're looking for, they're really not asking you a question to find out information. Many times they're asking you a question to put you to the test and see how you'll answer it. And if you don't answer it the way that they think you should answer it, they will disregard you as a teacher of the truth. And they may even tell other people negative things about you to try to limit or destroy your good influence with people. Has anybody ever asked you, why is it that you members of the Church of Christ think that you're the only ones that are right? You know, that's got dynamite all over it, doesn't it? Ask a question like that. Or you're studying with somebody and you're looking at the plan of salvation and they say, well, if what you teach is true, that you have to be baptized to be saved. My grandparents were never baptized, but they were the most godly, good people on the face of the earth. You're telling me they're lost? You know, you ever had a conversation with someone like that? You ever had a conversation with someone that says, well, you folks don't take money out of your treasury to help poor little orphans. You're just an orphan hater. Because we don't take money from the treasury and contribute to human organizations, because we have no authority in the scriptures for doing that. But people will make charges against us, call us orphan haters because of that. I don't know anybody in this room that hates orphans, do you? You know, if you hate orphans, raise your hand. I don't see any hands raised. Nobody in this room hates orphans. You don't believe the church ought to help get children off the streets. I was told that when a conversation with an individual that was telling me, oh, we just spent $200,000, $250,000 building a brand new gymnasium. But why'd you do that? We want to keep kids off the street. You're going to spend that much money from the treasury of the church so that young children will not turn over somebody else's trash can in their yard, will not roll the trees in front of their house, won't ring the doorbell and run. What are you trying to do? Do you realize how many gospel preachers could be supported by that $250,000 that you're spending and the interest on it? Do you realize how many gospel preachers could be supported? Well, it's important to keep kids off the street. Is it really? You know, did the Lord, when He was dying on the cross, remind everybody that the most important mission of His people is to keep children off the streets? Strange motives, don't you think? Matthew 26, 47 through 49. Jesus, in the betrayal scene, when Judas betrays Jesus, he comes to him, and he had given a sign saying, whosoever I kiss, he's the one, sees him. Immediately Judas went to Jesus and said, hey, Rabbi, and kissed him. Now, what is a kiss? Isn't it normally an expression of friendship, a sign of friendship, a sign of great affection? And here is Judas kissing Jesus, using this great sign of affection to betray him, to identify who he is in the darkness of the night. People today give outward signs of friendship and affection as if their greatest love belonged to Jesus Christ, but many times they do it for the wrong motives, the wrong reasons. Probably there are some who sing, oh, how I love Jesus, who really don't have any greater love for Jesus than somebody like Hugh Hefner or Lee Harvey Oswald or somebody like that. But they'll sing that song. It's not for me to necessarily judge what their motives are, but God knows what their motives are. And God is the one to whom we will all answer, and the content of the heart will be known. In Acts 4, verse 36 through chapter 5 and verse 6, we have a situation in the early church where many people were gathered together in Jerusalem. Many conversions were had, and the people were continuing in the doctrine of the apostles, and they were soaking it up like a sponge. They were interested in the doctrine of Jesus Christ. They wanted to be Christians because they realized that Jesus Christ was God's King. He was Lord of lords, King of kings. He is the one through whom our hope is alive. He is the one that will bring us into fellowship with God and keep us there. They realized that. And because of the great amount of people that were there, and they're continuing to hear the apostles, they didn't all live in Jerusalem. They were staying there for the feast. But under normal circumstances, you would expect that many people would have great needs, and they did. And there were some who sold land and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet, in order that their needs might be met. Well, in this context, there's a person named Ananias with his wife Sapphira who sold a piece of property, but they kept back some of the price for themselves. And Ananias knew this, and his wife had full knowledge of it. We're told in verse 2, It wasn't the fact that they kept back a portion of it. The problem was that they misrepresented the amount received for the property. And they lied to the Holy Spirit by saying, this is all the money we got for the land, and we're donating it to the needs of everyone in the church here, when that was not true. And they were condemned for that. The thing wrong with this was that their motive was evil. And so evil that it prompted them to say something that was not true. This could have been a great example of laying up treasure in heaven if their motives had been pure, but they were not. So these are biblical examples of wrong motives. They're there to teach us something. They're there to guide us and promote within us purity of heart, purity of motives, whenever we do anything. Only a pure heart has pure motives. Look in Luke 6, beginning in verse 43, and you'll see this. Jesus said, there is no good tree which produces bad fruit, nor, on the other hand, a bad tree which produces good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For men do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they pick grapes from a briar bush. The good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth what is good, and the evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth what is evil. For his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. Years ago, some big-name preachers used to go around promising the younger preachers who were trying to prepare themselves to preach that they would receive high salaries and they would receive great benefits in their preaching work if they only stood for the right side on the institutional issues. And what they meant by that was, if you'll go along with what the college is teaching on that, then we promise you that you'll be well taken care of. Now, for a young person without much experience in that area, do you see how that could be an enticement to compromise the doctrine that is taught? For him to compromise the truth? If you'll just land on the right side of this question, we'll take care of you. You know, that would be an impure motive for doing that, wouldn't it? I fear that the motives of some have led them to adopt certain views because they are most profitable in terms of prestige and wealth. And that's a bad situation. Whenever we choose to attend a certain congregation, it should be because of conviction. It should be because we're confident that the truth is taught there, that is promoted there, it is exalted there, that book, chapter, and verse preaching is what happens from the pulpit and in the Bible classes. I've known people who attend where they do because it's convenient for them. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a lady one day, and she said, well, I believe that a person ought to attend the church that's closest to their house. Where did Jesus ever say that? Where did the apostles ever admonish people to attend the church that's closest to your house? You won't find that anywhere in the scriptures. And especially, that wouldn't gel too well with today's modern society, because there are churches of every stripe and every color and every doctrine, and whatever anyone wants to believe, there's a church raised up for that belief in our world today. I had a couple tell me one time, came to me many years ago, and they said, well, we weren't at services this morning because we were running late, and so we went to another church. We went to a church that was closer. We were just running late. Well, which one was that? You get some strange looks and some strange comments from people sometimes. There are people who base their selection upon the people who are there. Well, I want to go to church there. Why? Well, you know, I'm in the selling business. And actually, with the small church that you're a part of, I wouldn't be able to meet very many people, probably wouldn't be able to sell much of my merchandise or whatever it is I'm peddling there. I want to go to a big church. I'll meet a lot of people there, and I'll be able to sell a lot of stuff and make a good living. Would that be a good motive for attending a church, you think? Where your socially and politically influenced people are in a large numbers? Would that be long? Would that be correct? What about basing your decision upon, well, the reason I'm going to that church is because I've gone there all my life. The reason I'm going to that church is, well, my parents go there. My grandparents go there. My friends go there. Is that the sum reason of why you go there? Well, pretty much. I had an individual tell my brother asked one of his best friends one day, why are you a Roman Catholic? I just want to know what your reason is. You know what he said? Well, that's what my parents were. What is that okay? For us to be what we are religiously because that's what our parents were? What about the children of idolaters? Philistine children whose parents were idolaters. And someone walked up to them, some Israelite walked up to them and said, why are you an idolater? And they said, because my parents are. Would that be a good enough reason? You know, we can see it in that context, can't we? That just because your parents are one thing, that shouldn't necessarily provide the motivation for you to be that thing, would it? You know, there are some people who are Christians today whose parents, whose father was a drunkard who beat his wife. Would you want to be a drunkard who beat your wife just because your father was? That'd be an incorrect motive, wouldn't it? To do things strictly on that basis. And I think, you know, we can see applications like that, can't we? And that's why Jesus points to the fact that it's the good and pure heart that acts in righteous ways that glorifies God and blesses those who act in those ways. You know, it is very good for us to examine our motives for doing things to make sure they're right. Make sure that the Lord would approve of the attitudes that we have that motivate us to act. That's what we're concerned with. We want the Lord to be happy with us. We want the Lord knows our reasons for acting. We want the Lord to be happy with our reasons for acting. We want to put a smile on the Lord's face. And if we have this heart, it will ensure that we have the proper motives. And here it is in Mark 12 and verse 30. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. If that's our drive, our motives will be pure, we won't have anything to worry about. And we can encourage others to have pure motives too. Thanks for listening to me tonight. I appreciate it so very much. I appreciate the prayers on my behalf. I don't say it every time, but I really do. I appreciate that so very much. If you're in our assembly tonight and we can help you in a spiritual way to become a Christian, to be maintained as a Christian, we'd be happy to do that. We can pray with you and pray for you. We can baptize you into Christ if that's your desire tonight. If we can help you tonight by your response to the Lord's invitation, then please do that now while we stand together and sing the invitation song to encourage you.